everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Each week at this time, we explore different issues in depth, generally one issue per week with one or two or more guests. Today, we are going to explore several different issues, including Omar Gaddafi's gold. What happened to it? The gold denier. Is that the real reason, along with his oil and the fact that he was a lightning rod? Was that the reason that we decided to destroy Gaddafi in Libya? Look at it today. We're going to explore that. Also today, we're going to look at Empire Files. This ship is sinking, and that person is Lawrence Wilkerson. Colonel Wilkerson was the chief of staff for Secretary of State Colin Powell, and he has insider information about the truth of the so-called weapons of mass destruction and what really got us into the conflict in Iraq. Also today, Hillary Clinton's hypocrisy. Cheryl Atkinson, leading reporter, speaks out on it. Also a very short clip on the new form of McCarthyism and how it's exploiting fear. The person giving it, Edward R. Murrow, possibly the best journalist in American history. I'm sure you've heard that there was a police department in Alabama that was substantially controlled by neo-fascists and people who were white supremacists. And they literally set up, exploited hundreds, if not thousands, of blacks to be arrested, planting evidence. We'll talk about that. So we have all these plus. What happened to the Ukraine's gold following the coup? Now, joining us today will be our scholar in residence and the producer, Richard Gale.
Hi, Gale.
Richard comes to the program with a deep background since on all these topics because every day, knowing that we are being listened to not just by friends but by those who oppose our views, we are meticulous in our research and scholarship to make sure that the facts we present are accurate. So we're going to give you some in-depth understanding of these issues. Let us begin by taking a look at Gaddafi's currency. And is this the real reason that NATO and the United States attacked him?
Well, more speculation has been raised on the reasons for NATO's intervention in Libya. And as RT's Laura Emmett reports, the organization may have been trying to prevent Gaddafi from burying the American buck.
According to some, it's about protecting civilians.
We must not tolerate this regime using military force against its own people.
Others say it's about oil.
The only reason they're interested in, with Libya is about the oil. You'd think we'd be in Iraq if the major export there was broccoli.
But some are convinced intervention in Libya is all about currency, specifically Gaddafi's plan to introduce the gold dinar, a single African currency made from gold, a true sharing of the wealth.
It's one of these things that you have to plan almost in secret, because as soon as you say you're going to change over from the dollar to the something else, you're going to be targeted. There were two conferences on this. One in 96 and another one in the year 2000, called the World Mataba Conference, organized by Gaddafi. And everybody was interested. I think most countries in Africa were keen.
Gaddafi didn't give up. In the months leading up to the military intervention, he called on African and Muslim nations to join together to create this new currency that would rival the dollar and euro. They would sell oil and other resources around the world only for gold dinars. It's an idea that would shift the economic balance of the world. Countries' wealth would depend on how much gold they have, not how many dollars they trade. And Libya has 144 tons of gold. The UK has double that, but 10 times the population.
If Gaddafi had an intent to try to reprice his oil or whatever else the country was selling in the global markets and accept something else as a currency, or maybe launch a gold dinar currency, any move such as that would certainly not be welcomed by the power elite today who are responsible for controlling the world's central banks. So yes, that would certainly be something that would cause his immediate dismissal and the need for other reasons to be brought forth for removing him from power.
It's happened before. In 2000, Saddam Hussein announced Iraqi oil would be traded in euros, not dollars. Sanctions and an invasion followed. Some say because the Americans were desperate to prevent OPEC from transferring oil trading in all its member countries to the euro.
The UK's gold is kept here in a secure vault somewhere in the depths of the Bank of England. As in most developed countries, there's not enough to go around. But that's not the case in places like Libya and many of the Gulf states. A gold dinar would have given oil-rich African and Middle Eastern countries the power to turn around to their energy-hungry customers and say, sorry, the price has gone up and we want gold. Some say the US and its NATO allies literally couldn't afford to let that happen. Laura Emmett, RT, London.
Now, let's ask ourselves a basic question. We were told by Hillary Clinton, the President of the United States, all of the talking neocons on Fox, MSNBC, even PBS and NPR, that this was a necessary intervention in order to protect the people. Well, take a look now. And to give us an eye view of what Libya was like before the invasion, and then compare it, let's say, to our ally today, and our ally for the last 55 years, Saudi Arabia. Let's look at women's rights in Saudi Arabia. Let's look at how many women have the ability to drive a car or to go out in public with a man other than their husband. Compare that to Libya. Look at the average wealth of a person in Saudi Arabia versus in Libya. So let's just make a comparison, because the media will not touch this at all. And even on Saturday night, when addressing the issue of let's look at Libya today, I couldn't believe what I was listening to when Hillary Clinton said that, well, we've made efforts to help them. And I'm thinking, wow. And the American media, especially the left, are going to give her a pass on that stupidity. Richard Gale is not going to give anyone a pass on anything. Richard, take us through a journey of Libya and Saudi Arabia and some of the other countries that are allies versus what was going on in Northern Africa.
Nick, Ari, just before we started this, there was a I watched the last interview that Gaddafi had given before the invasion, and unfortunately wouldn't have been appropriate for this because it was translated, his responses to the questions, so it would have been just a text. But, you know, one of the things that differentiates Gaddafi from other Arab tyrants in these other countries is primarily that Gaddafi saw himself as a liberator of the poor, and we see many examples of that. Was he a dictator in many ways? There's certainly many faults that he had throughout, but he was not somebody who received that his position out of privilege. And what Libya was before and after Gaddafi were just. It's almost breathtaking to think that this one man was able to turn a country that was nothing but desert and tribal squabbles and bloodshedding into what was perhaps the most progressive country in all of Africa, even more so than South Africa, which we tend to align with. You know, for women, they were the best educated, and they had the highest per capita of educated women. If you were married, you were given immediately a car. You were given you were started with a bank account of about $50,000. If you their universities were filled with professors from around the world, from other countries, many Indians. Turks, Indonesians, Cuban doctors, and from other parts of the world. So they had a very, very progressive university system. If you were unable to receive, and that was all free, all the way up up through higher degrees. If you were unable to receive a particular degree in like a high technology or a medical field or something in IT or physics, you were paid for, your education was paid for to go overseas. All medical care was free by the government, paid for by the government. If the hospitals in Libya were unable to provide you with certain surgical procedures, your transportation and your fees were to have to go overseas for those operations would be paid for by the government as well. What Gaddafi was really doing was taking the resources of the nation back to the people, and clearly I don't think anybody can really argue that, given that an average Libyan lived much better off than the average American does today. So I think this is a very brief overview of that. Mm-hmm. And of course, today he had to be a strong man because Libya's is rather unique in its kind of tribal rivalries that go on compared to other North African nations. These tribal rivalries go way back, and without a kind of a strong man, Libya would always been in chaos. And now that a strong man is out of the picture, we see just all these tribal rivalries reemerging and more in a kind of a terrorist context.
We should also consider that Libya was fighting terrorists, would not allow Al-Qaeda or any other terrorist group in his country, and that is trying to balance hundreds of tribes and their interest. Also, there were more members of his parliament who are women than any other nation in the Middle East or in Africa. He also created the largest clean water aquifer in Africa.
That's right.
And he also provided fuel for the lowest amount of any country. Saudi Arabia, which has the lowest price for processing oil, about $6 a barrel, and that's very low. The average country has to spend about $60, still had a higher price for the citizens to buy gasoline than did the Libyans. Also, in Libya, you had very low crime rate. You had a very secular society. People could believe what they wanted to believe. There were multiple religious groups represented in Libya. Now, that is not to say that Gaddafi was a great person, but as you mentioned, he was the only person that I know of who actually shared the wealth of the country with the country, and as a result, and every indices, longevity, how long they lived, childhood poverty, they had the least, the highest education of their citizens, they had number one in Africa, and far dwarfed everything else in the Middle East. Largest representation of medical doctors who are women, largest representation of legislators who are women, and no debt to the average citizen, virtually no unemployment. In fact, he was so good to the workers who came there that those Somali and other countries went to Libya because they knew that they would not be exploited as they are exploited in other countries, including, by the way, one of the worst exploitations of the world today is the Haitians, who cannot find work in their own country, even though billions have been allocated. It never reached them. It reached the Clinton Foundation and other NGOs. They're now going into the trafficking business to Brazil. And since this is not legal, they have to pay about $5,000 per person to these coyotes to take them down to Brazil, which is a long trek. It's about 3,700 miles. And there, after working in different construction sites, generally for 2 to 3 weeks without being paid, then they're fired and they have no recourse because the people behind these sites are frequently top senators and people in power who say, too bad, leave. And Gaddafi was not known for that. If you came to his country and worked, you were paid. So when we hear all the media, especially the deplorable reporting on this topic from New York Times and or from, of course, from the network news, they're not going to say a good thing about Gaddafi or how he ran his country at all. They're only going to say he is an axis of evil. He needs to be destroyed in the American public government and media. We'll go right along with it. The average person will not be interested in looking for the truth. Now, let's now take a look at Saddam Hussein in Iraq. Libya is a failed state. It is a hotbed for terrorist activity. It was the place where Benghazi, where we were shipping out of not the mission, but on the CIA annex, we were shipping out arms to terrorist group, including al-Nusra, and that also ISIS got their hands on them, into the so-called moderate terrorist fighting Assad in Syria. That's why that mission was attacked and there was that firefight. And the reason that neither the president nor members of Congress, including the Republican caucuses, nor Hillary Clinton, will even touch this subject, because this is in violation of all international laws and would show that we have really come down on the wrong side of this. So they just don't deal with this at all. They focus instead of why didn't you get troops there? Why didn't you go in and help them? Instead of what were they doing there that would have caused this attack? Tell us now about Iraq and what Iraq was like prior to George Bush and the New York Times' Judith Miller making sure that Americans felt threatened enough that we invaded it.
With Iraq, well, it's we have similar situations in all these different countries where, and this is a long history the U.S. has. So if we look at not just Iraq and with Saddam Hussein moving more towards a nationalization of the resources so that that can go back into the building of infrastructure, social programs, the welfare needs, hospitals, educational systems. I mean, this is what Mossadegh did in Iran, and we had to oust him. Because he was nationalizing the private British oil companies. It's what happened in Angola when we threatened, and I know that for a fact because I was appointed with a Marine Corps outfit to be the medic if we were to invade Angola in 1977. And that, for the same reason, there was the nationalization of the resources going on there. Chile, the shift over from Allende to Pinochet, again, that was a question of the national, you know, Allende was nationalizing the resources. Pinochet was going to privatize them to Western corporations. In Indonesia, between Sukarno and Sukarto, where it was the same situation. The CIA got involved with that. So any of these, and we just, that cannot be allowed in the Washington consensus to be part of the U.S.-sanctioned international community that a nation goes and wants to throw out or limit Western corporate interests in the use of those of their resources at the expense of the nation that owns those resources for its own development. So that was what we also find is with Iraq and Saddam, and therefore you had a similar situation as with Libya. There was excellent universities. The Baghdad University is a very, very famous university. There was a preservation of culture there. I think Iraqis, even under Saddam, still had a very deep appreciation for their culture and its long history. And we saw that now with the raping of all the museums that went on. It was secular, as it is in Syria, so that women could be educated. They didn't have to wear hijab. They held professional positions, both private and within government. There's more women representation in government, not as much as in some of the other more secular Arab countries, but that was still there. And the Iraqis, they were much better among Arab countries. They were very highly educated population before the U.S. invasion.
Also, let us remember that in Iraq, it was shown under Freedom of Information Act documents that the Defense Department, with the full support of Hillary and Bill Clinton, intentionally and against all international laws, including Nuremberg, They bombed civilian infrastructure. They bombed the power plants, water purification systems, and then through sanctions prevented any materials to go in that would repair that. As a result, 500,000 young children died because of these privations. And when Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes questioned Madeleine Albright, who was Secretary of the Ambassador to the UN, and she was also Secretary of State, she said, yes, these are acceptable losses. What person in the right mind would suggest that 500,000 dead children is acceptable? But this is the mindset that goes on with these people. And it's not to suggest that Saddam Hussein was an ethical or decent person. He was not. He was a tyrant. And his Ba'athist party, which represented the Sunni faction, controlled everything, and only a small percentage of important positions were allowed to the Shia. But still, look at the entirety of the culture, not just the person running the country, and then ask yourself, today it's a completely failed state, plus it's got depleted uranium everywhere. And that's also true in Libya, and is now true in Syria, because all those bombs they're using, those are made of depleted uranium. And again, that's against all international treaties. We're going to play a clip now. By the way, before we play this clip, Libya had a lot of gold at the time, 143.8 tons and of gold. That's a huge amount of gold. And even at $1,000 an ounce, you're talking about enormous amount of money. What happened to that gold?
It's speculated that NATO took it. What's being blamed? It's kind of interesting. I don't think it's really clear. What the government is the U.S. government claims, is that Gaddafi had offshored all this missing gold, and a lot of it through supposedly in South African banks. On the one hand, it would seem kind of a little bit of out of place given Gaddafi. There are the other reports saying that NATO confiscated the gold, which would not be surprising because there's much more credible evidence to suggest that the, I forgot how many, is it 60, was it 60 tons or 60 tons of gold that went missing from Ukraine and apparently were flown to the Federal Reserve. That's more substantial. It's a more credible case. But here we're seeing both, Ukraine occurred, within the same time frame as with Libya, and so there is this suggestion, that the gold was taken by the U.S.
Let's now play a clip. This clip is a very in-depth discussion with Lawrence Wilkerson, who was the person who ran Colin Powell's office and was privy to all of those secrets that went on. And he is being interviewed on this important segment. Please listen.
Very quickly now, let's talk about the assets of the Gaddafi family. They could have billions of dollars of funds hidden in secret bank accounts if the reports are true. Now, what do you think should happen to this money?
Well, I think we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves. I mean, they're already talking about freezing the assets of Gaddafi. Well, I think a bigger question is, and your viewers should also look into this, and anybody, is that the Libyan National Bank has one of the highest per capita gold reserves of any state bank in the world. I think the only country that has a higher per capita gold reserve in bullion will be Lebanon, for the size of the country. So, what Gaddafi might have stuffed away in a Swiss bank account or a collection of Swiss bank accounts is minuscule compared to the state assets in terms of gold and oil that Libya possesses. And this has really been the game all along. It's about converting this state, this nation, into a more privatized, more globalist, to come under the globalist umbrella. So a complete refurbishment of Libya, and also it's a beachhead on Africa for the European and the Anglo-American countries. Libya is the only country that voted not to join AFRICOM, which is the U.S.'s Strategic African Command project, which is a child of the Project for a New American Century. It was started under George Bush. Libya did not want to be in AFRICOM, and that is one of the reasons maybe why they're getting the blunt end of the hammer from NATO right now.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your insight. Writer and filmmaker Patrick Henningsen talking to us from London.
Thank you.
Now, that was just a follow-up, but we're going to go on Libya. But now we're going to go to the Lawrence Wilkerson clip so we can hear this.
I'm sitting here in D.C. with the rare opportunity to speak with someone who served in the innermost circles of the U.S. war machine. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson is a former U.S. Army Airborne Ranger who flew over 1,000 combat missions in Vietnam. He was National Security Advisor to the Reagan administration and later served as Chief of Staff to Colin Powell during the Bush administration. You're a retired Army officer. You're a Republican. Given your inside experience in the government and military, how would you explain the purpose of U.S. foreign policy?
Today, the purpose of U.S. foreign policy is to support the complex that we've created in the national security state that is fueled, funded, and powered by interminable war and the ramifications thereof. That's a sad commentary on what America has become. But it's a realistic and, I think, honest appraisal of what America has become.
Mm-hmm. Has it ever been about altruism?
You could say there were even altruistic aspects to the slaughter and ethnic cleansing of Native Americans from the Mississippi to the Pacific Coast by Phil Sheridan's Army of the West, if you wanted to really dip into the bag and find something. But I don't think overall and comprehensively it's been altruistic. It's been about sheer power. And lately, it's not even been about realistic application of that sheer power or realistic attempts to expand it. It's been more or less so failed in its overall general aspects that it has diminished our real power in the world. And this is what concerns me most seriously, because history demonstrates, I think, that this is what empires do when they're getting ready to collapse. They began to be so zealous of their own power and its expansion that they actually decrease their power until it becomes inevitable that they cease to exist, or they don't exist in the same form they did when they were an empire.
And you've talked about the capital interests that are behind pretty much every U.S. military intervention in the last decade, if not century. What sort of economy are we waging war on today, and what capital interests would you say are behind the war on terror?
After World War II, the United States engaged in a monstrous twilight conflict, if you will, that it calls the Cold War. It's probably a pretty apt term. In that process, it built up what are the appurtenances now of a national security state, the military-industrial congressional complex, all the armaments industry that goes into that, the far-flung basing structure we have all over the world, which now is 800 or 900 places that we have little colonial dots, if you will, imperial dots, and to the wars that we're fighting now almost interminably. All of this is the leftover of what we did during that Cold War, to include physical expenditures beyond the scope even of human imagination. We have spent so much money on maintenance of our empire that it is becoming a critical part of it too. Our debt now is something like $18 trillion, unparalleled debt in my mind in the history of empire, in constant dollars or in current dollars. So this is a situation that's unsustainable, but it has come to a point where the power structure, which I would define as both the financial apparatus that this empire has generated and the economic aspects of it, which are less and less industrialized and productive, therefore, a real economy, in other words, and more playing with money and the interest on money and capital in general, as Thomas Piketty has pointed out in his book, Capitalism of the 21st Century, so eloquently. We now have more capital awash in the world than we have earned income. That is to say, earned income is a very second place in the world. capital is the real driving force in the world, and it's capital that's passed on from family to family, from generation to generation, and therefore corruptive and poisonous. We're in real trouble right now because of what this empire has generated, because of the incentives and motivations of it, and because it's basically run by about 1% of the people, if not fewer, in this country, constituting essentially a plutocracy. There are 400 families, 400 wealth centers, private wealth centers in the United States, constituted around a family structure that equal the gross domestic product of Brazil. Today I read a percentage which I can't even recall, it had so many zeros in front of it, but it was much less than 1% of the country has the approximate wealth of the GDP of India. So we're talking about a concentration of wealth and a concentration of capital, which is not productive wealth, unless it is actually going back into the real economy to generate industry that produces something, that is, it's unconscionable. It's reprehensible in many ways, because what you've got is the rest of the country, and in many respects the rest of the world, living off the rest of the scraps.
And it's totally unsustainable, as you're mentioning.
Yes.
This is a trajectory that is not going to last.
Not sustainable.
Behind the belligerents waging war, there are certain industries that are in play that continue to garner interest, extract resources.
Look at what's happening in Syria right now, for example. Just a microcosmic example. The Air Force is about to run out of ordnance. It has dropped so many bombs and shot so many cruise missiles that it's about to run out of ordnance. Well, I will guarantee you that companies like Raytheon and Lockheed and others who make these armaments are salivating, because they are going to be making another round of these armaments and into the interminable unknown future. They're going to be making these armaments. It's incredible what we're doing.
And in fact, they are salivating at that. Lockheed, Boeing, all of these different institutions, defense institutions, are openly talking about what a great benefit this is to them. The Syria war, all of these escalations. I wanted to read you a quick fact. In 2008, the Government Accountability Office found that over 2,400 former generals were employed at 52 of the biggest defense contractors as senior executives and acquisition officers. A high percentage of retired general officers go straight into jobs in the defense industry, making well over six figures, often with the corporations they dealt with while serving. How does this revolving door function? I mean, how close is this relationship in terms of actual foreign policy creation?
It's so close that you actually had during the Iraq War, and as far as my history lessons go, it's the first time it's occurred this way, and now is going on continuously. General officers who not only go out into the armaments industry and its associated paraphernalia and make money, based on their influence gain while in service, you actually have them going out and joining the media and making the media more conversant with and attuned to and want war. So you actually have general officers who will go out and go to CNN, go to MSNBC, go to Fox News, and they will get, again, your six-figure salaries for being the security experts on those news shows. And they will report to the American people the dire need for this continued conflict, the dire need for soldiers on the ground in Syria, the dire need for more war. It's incredible what has happened in that respect. That's not a direct contribution to the armaments industry, but it's certainly a very vivid contribution to the warmongering and to the interminable state of war.
Is it the interlocking board of directorates on these companies, or is it just the advertising that's straight injected into the corporate media?
I wish it were something that you could put your finger on like that. It's so many different things, including what you just said, but not necessarily consciously or coherently, except in some cases, I think. It's all of these things contributing, and it's not any one of them, as Eisenhower said in his farewell address. It's not something you put your finger on and say, aha, that's malicious. That's intent. It's not only complicit, it's intent. It's not that. It's this accumulation of vast power that's oriented towards what first increases its power and second what makes it rich that comes together and causes this. If it were something that you could root out and you can hand over to the FBI or to the Supreme Court or someone to adjudicate, it'd be a different matter, I think. Not that it would get done very easily, but it'd be a different matter. It's not something like that. It's pernicious. It's, as Eisenhower said, it's in every state house, in every federal office building. It's even in every home in America. It is this unconscious, sometimes, power-driven aspect of it that makes it so difficult to combat. In fact, I'll sit here and be a pessimist, a cynic, and I'll say we aren't going to correct this until something truly serious happens to right the ship of state, which might also sink the ship of state. Now we have every other general officer, admiral, walking out and signing up with glee to work for armaments.
Well, other than the egregious, unethical nature of how this functions, I mean, what is the legal caveat to how this is actually working? Is it just a machine that's working on its own and just continues to become more pernicious as time goes on?
They're not the most competent people in the world. They're not the most capable people in the world, and they're not the most, shall we say, professional people in the world. That's part of it. But a second part of it is it's become the thing to do. It's become de rigueur. I mean, it's what you do. If you serve 30, 35 years, you expect to have a six-figure salary with someone like Raytheon or Halliburton or Booz Allen Hamilton. We haven't even talked about the Beltway bandits that do more intelligence than the CIA. And I use that term very loosely there, intelligence. But it is a corporate complex that is growing, and it surrounds everything else, including what I call fateful decision-making, which is the decision-making to send young men and women to die for state purposes.
And speaking of the young men and women who go to die, there seems to be a huge class stratification, of course, between the people who are making the policy and the people who are actually giving their lives on the battlefield. I mean, if you join the military in today's age, whose interests are you serving when you do put your life on the line?
You're serving what one veteran in my seminar at William & Mary said to me not too long ago, about 3 weeks ago, Army veteran, Iraq, Afghanistan. You're serving the ulterior purposes of the leadership of the country. And I said, what do you mean by that? And he said, you're serving corporate and commercial interest. You're serving the interest of people who bureaucratically are seeking power within the structure. And you're serving the interest of what is basically an incompetent governing process. Wow, that was a pretty powerful statement, I told him, and he said, yep, and I'll never go back again, I guarantee you that, because I didn't realize that until I was about halfway through my last tour in Afghanistan.
Let's talk about the draft. It hasn't been in place for some time. On one hand, you have the military so desperate that they're paying NFL and sports stadiums for pro-military propaganda. On the other hand, you have women that are now being pushed to enlist in the draft. What are these measures of desperation mean, and what do you think about the draft?
It really isn't an all-volunteer force. It's an all-recruited force, because we're spending billions of dollars to entice these people who feel that they don't have many other prospects into the armed forces. We're bringing them into a service that's supposed to be professional, disciplined, and altruistic. We're bringing them in with the most heinous of selfish, greedy purpose. We're paying them what they couldn't make otherwise. We're giving them bonuses. It is so bad now that the cost for personnel in my Army, and to a certain extent in the Marine Corps, is coming close to being 50% of the cost of that service on an annual basis. If for no other reason, the all-volunteer force is going to bankrupt the Defense Department, so they're going to have to look at some other options. Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about your role in the Bush administration during the lead-up to one of the most devastating wars ever perpetrated by the empire, of course, the Iraq War. You not only served as Colin Powell's chief of staff, but you prepared his infamous speech to the UN about Iraq and its weapons of mass destruction. How did you miss the faulty nature of the intelligence given your week-long analysis, given the stakes?
I've looked at it from a much more, shall we say, soul-piercing way. Not only was the intelligence picture a failure on the part of the intelligence agencies for various reasons, it was also cherry-picked by the vice president. It was put together to a certain extent by the Office of Special Plans in Doug Feist's shop in the Pentagon, and it was largely orchestrated, as the MI6, the British memo said, it was orchestrated, shaped around the policy, or the policy was essentially, you know, fed with intelligence that would shape it, would feed it. So there were a number of reasons for the failure. There were a number of reasons for my own personal failure. I lament those reasons. I'll never forget the occasion. I'll go to my grave remembering it. But I can certainly, from an academic point of view, see how, and this is sad, and it frightens me to a certain extent, how this happened in the past, has happened in the past, or whether it's something in the future. For example, let me give you a vivid example. I'll tell you how I looked at the immediate reports that Bashar al-Assad had used chemical weapons in Syria a year or so ago. I said, bull. I'll believe it when I see evidence that it actually happened. And you know, I went to every person I knew in the intelligence community and every person outside the United States I knew, to include two people who were in Syria at the time, and I knew what was going on, and I respected their vision and their knowledge. None of them could confirm for me, not a single one, that Bashar al-Assad used those chemical weapons. Instead, there were possibilities they were used by other parties in Syria, as well as Bashar al-Assad, and frankly, the evidence looked more strongly for other parties than the president. So I still think there is high potential for this kind of manipulation of intelligence, this kind of fabrication of intelligence, and this kind of refusal to take dissent in the leadership in this country right now today. And I'll tell you very seriously, I'm very skeptical of the intelligence establishment and what it says.
Right. I mean, I always thought it was weird that the UN weapons inspectors were there on the ground, and that's when Bashar al-Assad decided to use the chemical weapons,
right,
when he already knew that was the red line. This whole red line mantra, I think, is really interesting, because why should weapons of mass destruction of any sort be that red line to actually legitimize the invasion and occupation of a sovereign nation? I wanted to say one more thing about the case. One of the biggest resonating factors, I think, in the speech was Saddam's anthrax stockpiles and bioweapons labs. Considering the fact that America had just been traumatized by its own anthrax attacks, where five people tragically lost their lives, why did you choose to hinge so much on anthrax in the speech?
No, as a matter of fact, we winnowed that thing to death. We threw tons of stuff out that we simply looked at and said, all this is an extrapolation from 1991 or 92. In other words, we looked at it and said, the CIA has no evidence that Saddam has done what they're saying he's done. All they've done is made a linear projection. If he was producing 6 ounces in 1991, and we knew that positively from the inspectors after the war, then he's now got 46 ounces because he could do 2 a year, you know, or whatever. That's what they've done.
Of course, it came out that the anthrax came from our own bioweapons lab. The final report from the FBI found no hard evidence linking Bruce Ivins to the attack.
Well, I don't know that. And I can't tell you why I don't know that, but I don't know that. I don't know it with the clarity with which you just expressed it.
That's what the FBI said.
Well, the FBI is as incompetent as any other bureaucratic entity within the federal structure, so...
Right, but I think it is pretty much conclusive that it came from within... I mean, the bio-grade of the anthrax came from within the U.S. establishment.
It wouldn't surprise me. It wouldn't surprise me.
Well, let's talk about what was your kind of deciding factor to speak out and be so vocal.
Torture.
Really?
When Powell came through my door in May, I guess it was, of 2004, and told me about some photographs that were going to come out, be made public, about a place called Abu Ghraib in Iraq. By the time I walked out of the State Department, I was ready to, you know, I was ready to go find somebody and cut his throat, because I knew that the United States had been involved in heinous activities in Vietnam. I knew they'd been involved in heinous activities in the Philippines. Indeed, a brigadier general, as I recall, had machine gunned 1,000 people in a ditch in the Philippines. And Teddy Roosevelt had sent him a telegram congratulating him until people found out what he'd really done. And then Teddy had to kind of withdraw that approval. But I knew we'd done some really bad things in the past, particularly in war. But I never, never knew in any time in our history where those bad things had not only been authorized at the highest levels in the land, but encouraged by the highest levels in the land. And I mean the president and the vice president of the United States and some of the cabinet officers. They were complicit in this. They gave instructions that they damn well knew were going to cause the armed forces of the United States to involve themselves in violations of the Geneva Conventions, the law of war, and the manuals that they operated under. That just threw me. That I said, I can't stay silent anymore. I'm going to speak out.
And looking back at the horrors of the administration, as you mentioned, the torture, wanton detention, and then, of course, the illegal war, essentially, that was based on false pretenses that cost the lives of a million Iraqis. Do you think that any members of the Bush administration should be charged with war crimes?
I've said so in the past. I do think they should be charged. I think six lawyers in particular ought to be disbarred immediately. They should have been disbarred immediately. I think they should probably also be tried.
Soldiers have been continuously dying in Afghanistan. It's America's longest war. Today they're still facing death, horrific injuries, for essentially no purpose, it seems. I mean, do you think they should understand the war in Afghanistan? What do you think their purpose should be?
The war in Afghanistan has morphed. It's not about Al-Qaeda anymore, and it's not about the Taliban anymore. It's about China, Russia, the soft underbelly, which is mostly Muslim of Russia, about Pakistan, about Iran, about Syria, about Iraq, about whether Kurdistan is stood up or not, and ultimately about oil, water, and energy in general. And the U.S. presence in Afghanistan, I'll predict right now, will not go away for another half century.
Oh my God, that's a horrible thought.
And it will grow. It will not decrease, it will grow.
And let's talk about strategic influence, especially, you know, we see this Cold War resurrection going on right now. As someone who's lived throughout the Cold War, the schism within the establishment when it comes to Russia and this new posturing with Russia. After the reunification of Germany, there was a promise on behalf of NATO that it would not continue to build up. What has
not
instead happened?
Not one inch further east is what Jim Baker, Secretary of State, said to Edward Shepard Nossel.
What interests are behind the buildup?
Why do we want more countries in NATO? Because then Lockheed Martin and Raytheon and Boeing and others can sell to them. Mm-hmm. Then the Soviets, now the Russians, won't be selling to them. Why do we want Ukraine?
Don't we have enough? I mean,
empire never has enough. That's the nature of imperial power. It never has enough. Have you ever watched Battlestar Galactica or Star Wars, you know, or Game of Thrones? Empire never has enough power. It never has enough wealth. It never has a more stable status quo. It has a increasingly unstable status quo, and so its efforts are ever more frenetic to protect that status quo, its power and its wealth, and to even expand them. That's the nature of empire. And that's what we are now. That's what we are. Everyone's protestations to the contrary, that's what we are. Mm-hmm. Depending on whose report you read, about a third, 20% I'll say to 30% of Russia's heavy armaments industry is in Ukraine. What do they do for tanks? What do they do for their heavy armaments in their military if Ukraine goes? The idea that we could do something in Ukraine, covert or otherwise, and have Putin not respond is just laughable.
You know, I feel like
that was Amy talking with Lawrence Wilkerson. Very important discussion. Richard Gale, your comments, please.
Oh, boy, where do you begin? Well, yeah. Listening to him, there are so many similarities, you see, with the fall of Rome. What really brought down Rome was the overreach of empire at a time of globalization, because really Rome was the empire that really started globalization. All roads lead to Rome, and those roads and pathways for goods and resources coming from throughout the Roman Empire that would go into Rome to build up the wealth of the Roman elite required military. At the time of the collapse of the Roman Empire, it was the military industry. If you were able to raise a real good thoroughbred fighting horse, that was the equivalent of Raytheon or a new catapult, or if you were a master at mass-producing swords or an armory. Those were the Boeings, those were the Halliburtons of the day, and just so many similarities. He's speaking about just the the condition of our armed forces and the soldiers today, and the bankruptcy that go. Rome faced the same thing. They had to invite the barbarians to fill in the ranks of troops, and we were doing that with giving immigrants the possibility of citizenship or a green card if you join the military. There's just many, many similarities that I thought were very interesting. And something that we forget is the importance of history. Americans are very clueless of history. I mean, that whole story of whether, that poll that was taken, whether we should bomb this country, Alhambra, which actually is just a fictitious city, and 30% of those polled said we should. And so there's a lot to learn from history. And how we repeat these patterns over and over again.
Richard, this is one of the most important spokespersons for truth in journalism in American history, Edward R. Murrow. Let's play the short one-minute clip.
Hysteria, the height of the Cold War, and the red baiting by Wisconsin Senator Joe McCarthy. Back then, a towering giant of American broadcasting, Edward R. Murrow, set the moral compass of the media and the nation straight.
We proclaim ourselves, as indeed we are, the defenders of freedom wherever it continues to exist in the world. But we cannot defend freedom abroad by deserting it at home. The actions of the junior senator from Wisconsin have caused alarm and dismay amongst our allies abroad and given considerable comfort to our enemies. And whose fault is that? Not really his. He didn't create this situation of fear. He merely exploited it, and rather successfully. Cassius was right. The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves. Good night and good luck.
When you consider today that if you are challenging with complete confidence in your scientific facts that vaccines are not all safe or effective, certainly not for every single person, you will undergo a form of medical McCarthyism. The media participates in it. It will only allow the pro-vaccine advocates an opportunity to share their points of view. Everyone else are the other. This is also true with the AIDS. If you are any one of the 3,000 journalists, scientists, Nobel Prize winners, and physicians who challenged how we're fighting the war on AIDS, you'll be called an AIDS denialist. And these people are representing a form of specific scientific McCarthyism. And we see it rampant. Your thoughts, Richard?
Well, with vaccines, what we've really seen in the media is how the media has demonized the opponents to the point to solicit fear in those who might sit on the fence regarding vaccines, or they don't know enough about vaccines, or they're a pro-vaccine within the public. And they've generated this fear that, the child who is not vaccinated is going to endanger and life-threatening children who, even if they're vaccinated, which is, totally ludicrous. If vaccines work, of course, then the child should be protected. For some reason, that line of logic doesn't seem to sink into the American public. But so it's really, I think, it's not just simply the marginalizing of dissonant voices. It's also framing them in a very perverted moral context, where these people are terrorists, they're criminals, they're culprits that endanger your life, and so that's what I see a lot of this is going, and it follows with what Mora was saying about the exploitation of fear, and we see this repeatedly.
You also see Lynn Bracken, you see Norman Pollack, you see Chris Hedges, Cornel West, all being marginalized as if they were too radical to hold any position of respect within any discussion on what has happened to our country. And that's by people who believe that the only system of governance should be the one we have, and that all you should try to do at your very best is to improve it slightly, but not to overturn it, not to challenge it, and there are thousands of voices, and we've had those thousands on the Progressive Radio Network, who state that the system is too far gone, it must collapse, and be replaced by one that is more fair, objective, and doesn't have corporate vulture capitalism as the anchor to which all other parts of it must subscribe. So I think that we are approaching that moment now, and I'm very pleased that we have forums still, not a lot, where people who have a difference of opinion can speak out without being tarred and feathered. And yet, even in so-called liberal media, MSNBC, Mother Jones, The Nation magazine, Pacifica, at the national office and also the management of most stations will not entertain or even allow dissenting voices on important public health concepts. And this is showing how far we have gone. Richard Gale, thanks for joining
us
tonight.
Thank you, Gary.
I'm Gary Noll. This has been a special edition of Progressive Commentary Hour, looking at many of the different issues that do not get the attention I believe they deserve, with some voices of reason out there. Thank you all for listening, and have a good day.